Time for us to talk baseball as we're joined on the G&M Family Market phone line by a contributor to FanRag Sports, Hardball Times. You've seen him on MLB Network as well, our friend Evan Davis checking in. Good Monday afternoon, Evan.
Always a pleasure, Rich. Glad to be back.
Yeah, nice to have you with us. Let's talk first of all about the Red Sox. The deal made about a week ago, but medicals ironed out and now official. Press conference earlier today introducing J.D. Martinez. What does that acquisition do for the Red Sox?
I mean, it's the acquisition that the team needed from the very beginning of the offseason. This was the most inevitable deal that I think anyone would have predicted when the winter kicked off. The fact that it took so long and the contract ended up being what it was is maybe the more interesting conversation. But yeah, the Red Sox need power. They were the best team with the least amount of power in the playoffs last year. They needed to find some thump after guys like Mookie Betts and Xander Bogaerts and Jackie Bradley probably were hitting more for power than their reputations or their skill sets would allow going forward back in 2016. And those guys did, in fact, take a step back, so they needed to find some thump. David Ortiz isn't around anymore. Hanley Ramirez is going to basically just be your league average first baseman, which isn't enough, especially the way that teams like to play offense now. And J.D. Martinez is probably being one of the four or five best hitters in baseball for the last four seasons. So it was a natural fit. The contract is fascinating, and not always in great ways. The deal is 5 years, $110 million guaranteed. The holdup was over this issue the Red Sox apparently had with his foot. He had missed some games at the beginning of last season with his one particular foot issue, and the Red Sox looked to try and give themselves, as they call it, protection from that injury. And Scott Boras, being the kind of agent that he is, was able to negotiate something away from Dave Dombrowski in order to allow the deal to go forward. And that was three opt-outs, which is remarkable. The first one coming after 2 years, and then the other two coming in each year after that. Paired with this very complicated and very intricate detail that involves the amount of disabled list time Martinez spends in those back end years as it particularly relates to this foot issue. I believe it's if he spends at least 60 days on the DL in the third year with the foot problem, then the deal becomes a mutual option. It's not just a player opt out. And I think that if it's a cumulative 120 days in the third and fourth years, then that fourth year opt out becomes a mutual option as well. A lot of moving parts, a lot of legalese kind of built into this deal. And I find it to be very indicative of how the offseason has trended when we see kind of the bigger names come off the board, like Yu Darvish has an opt-out built in very early into his deal. Eric Hosmer has an opt-out as well. And it seems as though this is the way that their agents, of whom Scott Boras represents two of those guys, are trying to extract value when teams have very clearly no interest in giving a lot of years and a lot of money to top free agents this offseason. It's very complex. I think Boras probably did the best he could do given the circumstances, but this is not a great sign for how free agency has generally been done in the game of baseball and how it could potentially be done going forward over the next few years before the next collective bargaining agreement is negotiated.
Speaking of that, just reading before we went on the air, a new post that you have up at fanragsports.com on the Logan Morrison signing, which you say is good for the Twins, but maybe not a good thing for baseball in general. Can you explain why?
Logan Morrison is an interesting player in that he has more or less been a league average first baseman who has dealt with injury issues for the majority of his career. He had a lot of prospect hype when he was coming up through the Marlins system and never exactly lived up to it. And then he was 29 last year and erupted for 30 home runs. He ran a 130 weighted runs created plus. He was walking all the time. You know, the contact quality suggested that this transformation was quite real and substantive. And I assume that even though maybe the market wasn't particularly great for first baseman going into the winter, this is a guy who probably justified a 3-year deal, probably in the $25 to $35 million range. I'd say that you probably, maybe not as much as I'd pay him if I were a GM, but that seems reasonable. And he ended up signing for one year and $6.5 million. And there are certain incentives kind of built into the contract based on playing time, based on performance. They could get that up to 2 years and $16.5 million, but that still is not a deal in any way commensurate, I think, with the abilities and the talents of Logan Morrison. Again, not a superstar, not a guy necessarily that's going to be making an all-star team going forward, but he offers you quality, particularly with power and patience at the plate. And the way in which that he has developed those skills recently would lead one to believe that he's more likely going to be, at minimum, good, at worst, average. And you don't pay an average to good player $6.5 million on a 1-year contract. A lot of teams who, when they have spoken publicly about how slow the offseason has moved, have said, you know, there's less of a robust talent pool this winter. You know, a lot of pundits have made the claims that because teams are thinking so similarly in terms of how they value production and projected value, thanks to their analytics departments, that this is inevitable, that teams are, quote-unquote, too smart to overpay for free agents, especially power-hitting free agents, and they're going into their age 30 seasons. And that might explain one or two things. It might explain why you only give Carlos Santana 3 years and $60 million the Phillies gave him. But it does not explain why Todd Frazier only got 2 years and $17 million, a guy who offers a lot of defensive ability and is a huge power bat. And granted, he may have given the Mets a little bit of a hometown discount because he wanted to stay in New York, but Todd Frazier should have gotten 3 years and $40 million based on his age and based on the kind of talent that he can offer a team over the next 3 or 4 seasons. And I think the same could be said for a guy like Morrison. Teams aren't using analytics to give players their fair market value. It seems like, with those two examples being the most obvious, teams are using analytics, or they are using their owners' desires to use the small market excuse as a reason not to pay free agents as a way to underpay guys. And if you don't offer a contract early in the offseason, it's been demonstrated that your price, those prices go down, because obviously players then get concerned about whether or not they're going to have a job once spring training, once the regular season starts, and so they're willing to take less money just to make sure that they're going to be employed. That is extraordinarily frustrating, and I think that means more and more money doesn't actually end up going into savings for the fans. And I think this is a common misconception when fans believe that that their hard-earned money that they spend at the ballpark or they spend on merchandise goes into players' pockets. That's not true. Ticket prices and merchandise prices don't have any effect on player salaries. And I think we also forget that the majority of the money that a team saves in free agency only goes back to the owners. It doesn't go anywhere else, especially the way that the CBA is structured now, where you can't spend an international free agency, you can't spend in the draft, you can't spend anywhere. And I think people might have believed, and certainly the union believed, that just meant the money was going to go back into free agent pockets, and that hasn't happened. And of course it wasn't going to happen, because that's never how ownership operates. You know, I discussed the idea of collusion in the piece, and there isn't necessarily concrete evidence at this point to suggest that that's what's going on here. But if collusion isn't happening, then there are a number of factors that all lead back to the idea that owners don't like to spend money on players, and they never have. And maybe you can say that the Yu Darvish and the Eric Hosmer and the J.D. Martinez contracts demonstrate that the big guys are getting paid, and therefore it's still acceptable. But what that really means is just that the middle class of free agents are losing out. And we still have so many pitchers in particular at the top of the market who haven't signed. Alex Cobb, Lance Lynn, Greg Holland, Arrieta himself. That's a really big concern. If there's no money going to the players, and there's no money going to international amateurs, and there's no money going to players getting drafted, then the game of baseball doesn't get better because free agents don't have a place to play for their true market values. It's starting to feel a little bit like the NFL now with some of the way that these contracts are structured. And I know I'm getting a little bit long-winded, but I worry for what is going to happen over the next few years before the next CBA gets negotiated, how well players are going to get taken care of in this new world we find ourselves in.
We're talking with Evan Davis. Evan, before we let you go, I wanted to ask you about Ohtani. The Angels have high hopes for him. He had kind of a rough outing his first time on the mound. Is it expecting way too much to think that this guy is going to take Major League Baseball by storm as a two-way player?
I think it was always maybe a little overblown, the idea that he could immediately become the next Babe Ruth, especially because you want him, I think, to be a pitcher, as much value as he might add at the plate, you have to kind of limit his plate appearances just to make sure that he stays healthy. And that outing, yeah, all right, he gave up a home run to Keon Broxton, but his fastball was also sitting in the mid to high 90s, and his splitter and his curveball looked absolutely devastating. And it's an inning and a third of a spring training game at the end of February. I mean, there's a lot of baseball to be played, not to mention the fact that we're still 5 weeks from the regular season. So he's got a lot that he can work on. Apparently he's already walked a couple of times today in his first appearance as a hitter. So I think that Ohtani, first and foremost, has got to be a frontline starter. I think everybody knows that that's what his main job is going to be. And if you get anything else from the bat, then that's fine. Just make sure that he's taken care of as an arm. And if he's not an all-star, that's okay. He's 23 years old. There's a lot of his career ahead of him and a lot of development that's most certainly going to happen. But there's still a ton of promise in what he can offer the future of the game.
Evan Davis, FanRag Sports, Hardball Times. Evan, always great talking baseball with you. Thanks for making time this afternoon, and we will catch up with you again very soon.
Such a pleasure, Rich. Thank you.